the death of Solomon this morning, and the kingdom being divided, and you will, by the way, be tested on everything that happens in lectures, and you'll be tested Friday afternoon, so we'll tell you right now, all you need to know is everything we cover, okay? Simple. So, we had a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. Who was king in the northern kingdom after the death of Solomon? Jeroboam the first. Good. Remember the first. And in the southern kingdom then it was? Very good. Okay, what's the name of the capital in the north? Samaria. And in the south it was? And what was in Jerusalem that was significant? Okay, and what were the three tribes in the south? Judah, Benjamin, Levi. Okay. What name was the northern kingdom known by? Israel. And the southern kingdom? Judah. Right. 1 Kings 12, verse 25. 1 Kings 12, 25. And we find in this little section Jeroboam confronted with a fairly serious problem. And we'll see what he did to solve it and what effect it had on the nation following his decision. 1 Kings 12, 25. Then Jeroboam fortified Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and lived there. From there he went out and built up Peniel. Jeroboam thought to himself, the kingdom will now likely revert to the house of David. That is to Rehoboam, who was descended from David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices at the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem, they will again give their allegiance to their lord Rehoboam, king of Judah. They will kill me and return to King Rehoboam. It's a very real problem because three times a year, at least all the males, all the Jewish males, went to the temple. They went at the Passover and at Pentecost and at Tabernacles. Three feasts. And for all those feasts, every Orthodox Jewish male went to Jerusalem. And if they continued to look at Jerusalem as being their true capital, then the time would come when they'd want to get rid of Jeroboam and they would kill him. And he wasn't too enthusiastic about that idea, so he wanted to prevent them from going back to Jerusalem. So, verse 28, after seeking advice, the king made two golden calves, or calves. He said to the people, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. One he set up in Bethel and the other in Dan. And this thing became a sin. The people went even as far as Dan to worship the one there. So, in order to prevent them going to Jerusalem, as a matter of political convenience, he brought in a whole new religion and he made two golden calves and he told people to worship those. Now, what's wrong with choosing a golden calf as a symbol for God? Why did he choose it? What's wrong with it? Well, of course, in the commandment, God said you're not to make any graven image of anything. It's in the heaven above or the earth beneath. Nothing. Not to bow down to those or serve them. Why not? Because it is impossible to make any kind of an image which is going to be an adequate representation of God. The reason he chose the golden calves was for two reasons. One, the calf was a very strong animal. A bull calf was a powerful animal. They didn't know much in those days about dynamite or diesel engines. Caterpillar weren't in business. And if you wanted to plow up your ground or something like that, you used a bull calf. And it was a strong animal and therefore a symbol of strength. It was also a symbol of wealth and fertility. The most valuable possession most farmers would own would be a male calf. So it was a symbol of wealth, fertility, and strength. And that's what they were interested in. They wanted a God who was strong and could defend them, and a God who could make them prosperous and make both their farms and their families multiply. So they chose the symbol of a calf. But a calf is a defective symbol, first of all, because it's not very intelligent. So it's a very unsuitable thing to choose to symbolize God, because now you've got a God who is less intelligent than you are. But of course you can make a calf do what you want it to do. So in that way it's useful, it can be manipulated, it can be organized, it can help you by making you wealthy or by lending it strength, but intellectually it's less than a person. The other defect about a calf is this, that it has no morals. It's not immoral, but it's amoral. It just doesn't have a moral dimension to its life. You don't talk about a wicked calf. It's just a calf. It's the way calves behave. So the calf was a poor substitute for God because it left out his moral character and it left out his intellect. In other words, it was stupid and morality no longer affected their worship. And you always become like the thing you worship. So they became a people without morals and a people who are stupid. And it may be convenient to have a God that you can order around, but he'll never be a God who's big enough to worship. And he'll never be a God who is really big enough to get you out of a hole or to give you advice or guidance. Having done that, things went from bad to worse, and they adopted a few other forms of worship, which were really brought in by Solomon, but they took greater hold in the northern kingdom. Back in 1 Kings 11, and verse 1, King Solomon, however, loved many foreign wives besides Pharaoh's daughter. Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites, they were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, you must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. Verse 4, as Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods. And his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God as the heart of David his father had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely as David his father had done. So the worship that came in, particularly in the northern kingdom, was the worship of Ashtoreth, the worship of Molech, and also, what hasn't been mentioned, the worship of Baal. Baal was a Canaanite god, and he was most commonly worshipped amongst the native tribes of Canaan. Now, these gods had various characteristics. Baal was seen, the word actually means owner or lord with a small l. And in their thinking, every small bit of ground had its own Baal who owned it. And if you wanted a good harvest, then you had to please the Baal who owned the bit of land that you were trying to farm. And the way that you pleased him was by offering a sacrifice to him and also by having ritual sex. And the places where they worshipped Baal were known as altars, high places, groves, or green trees. They chose nice shady places under the trees or up on the cool of the hills to make the altars for Baal. And there they offered their sacrifices, and there the men held ritual sex with Baal's prostitute priestesses. Ashtoreth was a kind of female counterpart to Baal. And you kept Baal happy as well, and Ashtoreth, by pleasing her. That also involved sacrifice. And in addition to that, it involved the women having ritual sex with the temple priests. So there were priestesses to Baal and there were priests to Ashtaroth, both involving some sort of ritual sex. Then, in addition to all that, there was Molech. And his name means the great king. And Molech wasn't a little localized god, as was each individual Baal or Ashtaroth, but Molech was a great god, king over the universe kind of thing. He was very cruel. And he got very angry with you, and he was likely to blast you if he was upset with you. And the way that you kept him happy was to sacrifice your children to him, particularly your firstborn male child as a baby. And the way you sacrificed it was one of two ways. Either there was a very large bronze image of Baal who had a large pair of hands just a couple of feet up from the ground. And you lit a fire underneath, and when the hands were red hot, then you put your baby into those red hot hands, and Baal consumed your baby. If it wasn't that way, then the image was hollow, there was a fire inside, the mouth was open, and you threw your baby in through the mouth onto the fire inside. But whichever kind it was, you had your baby go through the fire and was consumed by Baal, and so his anger supposedly was appeased and he wouldn't blast you. So that was the route that the people of Israel in particular chose to follow. They worshipped Ashtoreth and Baal, which meant, by the way, you'll see various spellings of that. Sometimes it'll be Ashtaroth, and sometimes the Asherim. The same thing. Both those involve ritual sex. That involved the murder of the babies. Whereas in the southern kingdom, they stayed more loyal to God because they had the temple and they had the true priesthood there. And they had the sacrificial system that had been set up through Aaron. So, we're now going to proceed approximately 200 years. Okay? 200 years. And now we come down to the reign of Jeroboam the second, or Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. And these guys were the ones who ruled during the lifetime of the prophet Hosea. And please turn to Hosea chapter 4. Hosea chapter 4. Two 200 years have passed, and during those 200 years... this kind of worship has got a real stranglehold on the northern kingdom. And they no longer even think about going down to Jerusalem. Nobody does it. They worship Ashtoreth, they worship Molech, they worship Baal. and there's hardly any real worship of God left in the northern kingdom. The southern kingdom, things are still pretty good from that point of view. Not perfect, but reasonably good. Hosea lived in the northern kingdom, and he's a prophet to this northern kingdom. And I think it's very relevant that we should study the life of a man like this, living in times such as he did. Because these times are the kind of things that we're beginning to see, certainly throughout our major cities, and they're starting to penetrate our smaller towns and farming communities. And we might see something of how God used Hosea to communicate to his own times. Let's just look at what had happened after 200 years of this sort of worship. Hosea chapter 4. Hear the word of the Lord, you Israelites, because the Lord has a charge to bring against you who live in the land. There is no faithfulness, no love, no acknowledgement of God in the land. There is only cursing, lying, and murder, stealing, and adultery. They break all bounds, and bloodshed follows bloodshed. Because of this, the land mourns, and all who live in it waste away. The beasts of the field, and the birds of the air, and the fish of the sea are dying. Just look at that a little bit more carefully. Imagine living in a country in which there was no faithfulness. In other words, you couldn't expect anybody to keep their word. Whatever they promised you, you wouldn't expect them to do it. Family relationships in which there's no faithfulness. Business relationships in which there's no faithfulness. Okay? No love. Can you imagine a country in which there is no love? Somebody was telling me, one of you, was telling me about working with the people who come from foster homes to spend their summer vacation here. And how each one of them is just desperate to be loved. Never really known any love, and they want to know it. Then think about a land in which God is not acknowledged at all. Nobody recognizes him. And remember that these were the people of God. These were the people who had been brought out of Egypt. These were the people who had been brought across the Red Sea. These were the people who sang songs of praises in the desert. These were the people to whom God gave his commandments. These were the people to whom God had sent all his prophets. They had a tremendous history of privilege and blessing and divine activity, and yet this is the condition to which they've fallen. And if it can happen to them, it can happen to anybody. It can happen to your country, it can happen to my country, and it is doing. Verse 2, there is only cursing. In other words, no respect for the name of God. Lying, no appreciation for truth. Murder, no appreciation for life. Stealing, no appreciation for property. And adultery, no appreciation for marriage. What kind of a society is that? No appreciation of God, of truth, of life, of property, or marriage. People of God. Once. They break all bounds. In other words, it doesn't matter how permissive your standards are, how loosely you set them, wherever you set them, they will break them. They will not be contained by any kind of boundary. However low and despicable your standards are, they'll go lower. Human nature. your nature too. You may be fortunate that you've been brought up in a different background, but under the right conditions or the wrong conditions, this is the way you go. People are like this. They break all bounds and bloodshed follows bloodshed. That is literally in the Hebrew, blood touches blood. And the picture is a very vivid one. It's like walking down the sidewalk and somebody's been knifed in the road and has died there and bled, and there's a big pool of blood on the sidewalk. But so close is the next murder to that one that the blood stain from that one merges with the blood stain from this one. And blood touches blood. That's the picture he's using here. And it was also true in the royal palace. King after king in Israel's line was murdered, usually by his successor. And there was several cases of kings who reigned less than a year because they were murdered before their first year was up in the kingdom. And this had an effect on even the natural order of things. He says, because of all this, beasts of the field, the birds of the air, and the fish of the sea are dying. And that may strike an ecological chord to you today. The same thing is happening now. All kinds of species of animal life, plant life, insect life, fishes are dying rapidly. They'll never come back again. Largely because of the greed and the self-centeredness of man. He's just tearing the heart out of nature in order to get a fast profit, couldn't care less what happens to other people or to the nature that he's exploiting, and all kinds of species are dying. So it's a fairly gloomy kind of a picture. How can you possibly minister to people like this? How can you reach people like this? It's a lot easier to pretend they don't exist. They do exist. There are more people like this than there are like you. So let's begin now with Hosea chapter 1 and see how God is going to operate in these very difficult circumstances. Chapter 1, verse 1. The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, son of Beeri, during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and during the reign of Jeroboam, son of Joash, king of Israel. That puts the events in a precise historical context. Hosea's dates are approximately 750 to 700 BC. He is prophesying in Israel, the northern kingdom, although he occasionally makes comments about Judah as well. And he is described as being Hosea, the son of Beeri. And you probably know already, but every Old Testament name has a specific meaning. It's built up of fragments of other words. And every Old Testament name means something. It's not just a label. And they didn't really use them as labels the way that we do. And the name of these two people, Hosea and Beeri, his father, tell us something about them. The name Hosea means God saves. God saves. The whole comes out of Jehovah. And the Seah from the word to save. God saves. And the name Beeri means a preacher. Occasionally you may see it translated as well. But most scholars are in great unanimity that it means a preacher. So now you've got an interesting little picture. You've got a rotten society where nobody acknowledges God. There's no faithfulness. There's no love. There's no truth. no respect for the name of God or for life or property or anything like that. But in this absolutely rotten community, there is one man who is a preacher, and he has decided to call his son God Saves. Now, supposing we could update this and think about it in a modern context. We had a student once in Germany from the city of Reno, Nevada. And we didn't call it this, but he referred to Reno as Sin City. Having been there and ministered there for a week, I understand what he's saying. It's not quite as bad as all that. But it is a fairly corrupt place. But suppose it was completely corrupt. Sin City, Reno, Nevada. But there is one man in Sin City who is there as a true witness of God, and he is a preacher. And he's an evangelist, and he has gone there to establish some kind of Christian work in this stronghold of Satan, Sin City. And he is a teenage son. But when the child was born, he called him Jesus Saves. Now, can you imagine what that was like for the kid? Suppose your dad had called you that, Jesus Saves. Mm-hmm. And you'd gone to public school. And every time the teacher called a roll in the morning, you know, Jesus Saves, and everybody go. It was a message. It wasn't a particularly popular message. It wasn't a particularly easy message to live with if it happened to be your name. But Hosea had grown up with that. That was his name. And everybody in the community knew who Ba'eri was and knew who Hosea was. And they were a sort of weird little clean spiritual island in a sea of corruption. And Hosea is just about the stage that you're at in life, in which he is looking for God's purpose for his life. God, what do you want me to do? What do you want me to be? How do you want me to communicate to my times? What is the role that you've got for me? Tell me your will for my life. So God did. Verse 2. When the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, go take to yourself an adulterous wife and children of unfaithfulness. And that was the beginning of God's plan for Hosea. God, what you will for my life, I want you to go and marry a prostitute. That was a slight shock to the system, don't you think? It wasn't exactly what Hosea was expecting. Now, of course, not everybody believes that God really said that. There, if you read the commentators, you'll find they wriggle in all kinds of directions, some of them, to try and get away from facing up to that rather embarrassing instruction. Even the renowned Dr. Schofield of the Schofield Reference Bible has a little footnote, and he says, God didn't really say that, but he told him to marry this woman, and later she became a prostitute. That's not the way it's put. God told him to go and marry a prostitute. So he did. But I'd like to suggest to you that it was a very difficult command for Hosea to accept for a number of reasons. One, it was contrary to his understanding. It just did not make sense. See, if Hosea had thought about what kind of a person he would like to marry and what sort of a mission he was going to have in life, he would think about it in these terms. If I'm going to have a wife, she'll have to be a real asset to me in the work that I'm going to do. She'll have to encourage me to maintain my standards of purity and integrity in a rotten world. What we should be is a little oasis, a little picture of what a marriage can really be like in a rotten world. And they will see how good God's ways really are. And they'll be drawn back to him, maybe, or from that standpoint, we'll be able to teach them about the joy that comes from following the Lord and being obedient to Him. And if Hosea thought about it, it just didn't make sense at all for him, if he was going to have a real ministry, to go and marry a prostitute. How would that help him to communicate to his times? Well, God doesn't always restrict himself to what you can understand. And you need to be prepared for that. Just put something in Hosea and turn over to Acts chapter 8. In Acts chapter 8, Philip is having a terrific time communicating the gospel all over Samaria. People are getting saved, large numbers, churches being established. But Philip is told in verse 26 to go to the desert. Doesn't make sense. Who lives in the desert? Nobody lives in the desert. If you want to communicate to people, you should go where the people are, not to the desert where nobody lives. And here he is having a successful campaign in one place, and God says, leave that and go to the desert. So Philip went to the desert, and he's down on the road in the desert when there was a considerable number of people came along, because they always travel in large numbers for safety. And amongst them, there is a man who is really looking for God. He is the finance minister to the Queen of Ethiopia. And so much is he looking for God that he's been to Jerusalem to try and find him. He's been to the temple, didn't find God in the temple. What he did find was a little Jewish businessman who sold him a genuine souvenir copy of Isaiah's prophecy. And he came away with 66 chapters of Isaiah, with no verse or chapter divisions, all rolled up in a mammoth scroll. And he's reading through it, and he's read 52 chapters and not understood a word. But he's so earnest to find God that he's continuing. And Philip's down there, and the Ethiopian is in a chariot. And the Spirit of God says to Philip, go and attach yourself to that chariot there, that really wealthy-looking one with a blue velvet curtains and the gold tassels. And so Philip goes along and he starts jogging alongside this chariot that's moving down through the desert. And Philip's not great at jogging, and he's out of breath and he's a bit sweaty and he's forgotten his deodorant, and he's not all that much of a representative to look at him. And here is this distinguished man, government minister, leaning back against the velvet cushions there in his chariot, all eau de cologne and the rest of it, and silk handkerchiefs, reading out loud from Isaiah 53. And if there is one place in the Old Testament from which it's easy to preach the gospel, it's Isaiah 53. And before Philip knows what's happening, he stuck his sweaty little head in through the curtains, and he says to a government minister, hey, do you understand what that's about? And the government minister is so anxious to learn what it's about, he says, no, but if you know, come and tell me. So Philip climbs up into the chariot and he sort of settles back against the cushions and he thinks, here we go, suffering for Christ again. And what it says literally is this, he opened his mouth and out came Jesus. Beginning at the same scripture, he opened his mouth and out came Jesus. And in the course of the next mile or two, the Ethiopian was led to Christ. Just as he was convinced in his heart, not only that Jesus was the Son of God, but that he was going to accept him personally, they arrived at an oasis where he could be baptized. Timing is terrific. And God got Philip, a willing worker, right alongside a seeking soul, right together in the desert, and brought them to the water just in time for him to get baptized. Then the Ethiopian went back to Ethiopia, equipped with the prophecy of Isaiah, from which he could minister to his own people and take the gospel to a country not yet evangelized. Philip then went back to his own mission in Samaria. But if Philip had stopped to argue and say, hey, I don't understand this. Why have I got to leave my busy mission field here and this successful time I'm having here to go down to the desert when nobody's there? If he'd stopped to argue, he'd have missed the Ethiopian. If he'd been even 2 minutes late, he'd have been on chapter 54 instead of 53. It's much more difficult to preach the gospel out of Isaiah 54 than it is out of Isaiah 53. And God's timing is perfect, but Philip had learned obedience, instant obedience, without argument, even though he didn't understand the reason. And I suspect that many of us, quite frankly, if we were honest, we would say this: God, explain your will to me. When you've explained it to me, if I understand it and I can agree with it, then I'll do it. But God is a little bigger than your understanding. If God were no bigger than your understanding, he wouldn't be much of a God, would he? So you need to be prepared sometimes to obey, even though you do not understand why you have to do it his way, or why he's saying what he does. Because he does not explain himself to Hosea. He just says, go and do it, and Hosea went and did it. Second, it was a difficult command to fulfill because it was contrary to his personal desire. You see, if Hosea was going to be married to a woman like this, she would despise him. And he was not just to be married to her, he had to love her. And even though he loved her, she would not love him. And though he was going to be faithful to her, she was not going to be faithful to him. When he went out, people would know who he was, who his wife was, what kind of a wife he had. His pride would be utterly humiliated every time he went out in the street. It was a rotten society. People knew what his wife was. They would make comments to him. The kind of wife he wanted would be the sort of wife who would love him. The sort of wife would be good to have around, who would appreciate him, help him to maintain his self-respect, etc. The last thing that Hosea wanted was to be stuck with a woman like this. You know, and somebody said that marriage is a word. It's not a word. It's a sentence. A life sentence. It lasts a long time. You can't get out of it. And Hosea was going to go through this for the rest of his life. It's what God's talking about. And it was the last thing, probably, that Hosea would personally want to do. But he did it. In Acts chapter 9, you meet another willing worker, not Philip this time, but Ananias. When you meet Ananias in Acts chapter 9, he's packing a suitcase because he's heard dire threats about a man called Saul of Tarsus who is coming to town. And Ananias lived in a dangerous city called Damascus, which was Saul's next target. And just as Ananias is packing his suitcase to get out of town, God speaks to him and says, Ananias, and he says, yes, Lord, I've got somebody I want you to go and speak to. Well, that's fine, as long as it doesn't take too long, because Saul of Tarsus is coming here and I want to leave before he gets here. Who have I got to talk to? Saul of Tarsus. Oh. What? Hey, just a minute, I heard about that guy. And he throws people in prison. And I'm allergic to prison. And if there was one person in the world that Ananias really didn't want to meet, it was Saul of Tarsus. Saul of Tarsus was responsible, personally responsible, for the stoning to death of Stephen, murder. And and for the imprisonment and brutal treatment of a large number of Jews of Christian Jews in Jerusalem. And Ananias must have known quite a few of them. And this man was responsible for doing that to his friends. And had come here to do that to Ananias and to his friends in Damascus. And if there's one person Ananias really didn't want to go and see, was Saul of Tarsus. But on instruction, Ananias set aside his personal desires and he went. Good thing he did. Saul was converted, and through Saul, of course, many churches established and the gospel brought to Europe. A large section of the New Testament was written. But I think a lot of us, quite frankly, have this kind of idea: God, tell me your will for my life and I'll have a look at it. And if I like it and it really appeals to me, then I'll do it. But if I don't like it, forget it. I don't want to know. That's not obedience. It's just pleasing yourself. And unless we're committed, first of all, to obeying God, whether we understand it or not. Second, to obeying him, whether we like it or not. We're not obedient, we're disobedient. And if we're disobedient, it may well be that God won't say anything to you. It's not until we come to the place where we're really prepared to obey that he begins to speak. Third reason why it was difficult, it was contrary to his religious background. See, Hosea's father and presumably his mother were godly people. And he loved them and he respected them. He knew that society outside was rotten and he could live with their insults. He got used to that. He'd grown up with the name Hosea. And he'd got used to being despised by the people outside, but he valued the good opinion of the people inside, particularly his own parents. Now, put this back in the context of Reno or whatever. And Hosea comes in to see his dad and his mother. And he says, "Hi, Dad, I've got some news for you." "Oh, what's that?" "Going to get married." "Really? Didn't know you were interested in anybody. Who are you going to marry?" "Gomer." "Gomer? Don't think I know a Gomer, son. She doesn't go to our church, does she?" "No, Dad, she doesn't." "Which church does she go to?" "Actually, Dad, doesn't go to church." "Oh, really? Well, what does she do then?" "Funny you should ask that, Dad, really." And when Hosea explained who he's going to marry, his dad smiled, patted him on the shoulder and said, "Great, son, that's just the sort of little girl your mum and I always dreamed you'd marry." You think so? Very difficult. He valued their opinion, their respect. And it was obviously going to hurt them. I can't imagine any parent understanding in these kind of circumstances. And yet, the scripture makes it very clear. Jesus makes it very clear. If anyone loves mother, father, husband, wife, children more than me, he's not worthy of me. And that means that your love for him has to come supremely first, and it may well be tested. And if it's tested, it must mean that the rest of your family will somehow not understand and be hurt. And while it isn't the sort of thing we do every day, and we're not supposed to do it every day, and the command to honor your father and mother applies to adults, There may come times when you have to go against their desires and wishes in order to be faithful to God. We need to stop there. Time's run out. Let's pray together. Father, these are searching kind of ideas. An obedience when we don't know where we're going. An obedience when we don't like what we're being called upon to do. An obedience when it's not popular with anyone. Not only do the godless laugh at us, but our nearest and dearest and most respected friends can't approve of what we do. Lord, it hurts to go a lonely road like that. Our beings rebel against it. And yet, Lord Jesus, we thank you that that was the very road you trod. But here on earth, Lord Jesus, you are not understood. None of the disciples appreciated what the cross meant. They tried to dissuade you from it. Your family didn't want it. Nobody understood what you were doing. And yet you are faithful. And Lord, when I search my own heart and I consider my own view of obedience and the route that I've followed so far, I'm disturbed and challenged in the depths of my being, because I recognize most of the time I live according to my own understanding, according to what pleases me,